Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg and Adam Barrett. Hey, I believe you're on the line.
Yep. How you doing, Fred?
Good, good. You got your coffee all set to go here at the at our virtual coffee shop chat?
I'm all set, yes.
Okay. Well, when this episode comes out, we'll be in the midst of the holiday season. And here in the U.S., it's Christmas time, or and gift giving's a big part of that. Now, I don't know about you, Adam, but I'm woefully unprepared and generally unwilling to go into shopping malls during this time of year. But it's one of those things that if you plan ahead a little bit, you can, you know, handcraft stuff or like for my kids, it's usually cooking meals and dinners and stuff, which takes a little prep and so on. But it's one of those things that a little bit of planning can save a lot of heartache, a lot of problems down the road.
Yep.
Which made me think of a client recently was talking about, oh, we need to do, you know, yeah, I know in the plan you created with us a year ago, and they've called me back in, and they said, well, it's time for us to start doing reliability testing. We're going to launch in a couple of months, and we probably need to do some testing. Which is a trigger for me of, well, they're not really thinking about this very much. And I said, all right, well, how many samples do you have set aside for your testing? And, you know, a couple thousand? I said, hopefully. And they laughed and go, oh, you need samples?
Right. Right, exactly. Exactly.
No. So how exactly am I supposed to... You know, there's only so much we can do with the complexity of your product based on physics of failure models or, you know, engineering judgment and all those other things. At some point, we really do need to go break one and see what fails. And we should have really done that months ago. But this particular situation is they sold that first one to a waiting customer, and they got some valuable information from the customer. That's fine, except we lost the opportunity to do a lot of engineering work on it and
right.
to learn stuff. And I thought, wait a sec, you know, this was kind of in the discussion and plan all along that we're going to need on the order of 100 or so of these units to evaluate and break and not sell later. And that just didn't seem to sink into the psyche at all. It just...
Yeah, it's interesting because there's, you know, a lot of different ways to approach it, because even if it is a hard fact that you're not going to get additional units, like you said, a little bit of preparation can go a long way. What if instead of that, if the, you know, customer knows that they're getting an alpha unit that they're kind of getting to use and be a little bit of a test, you know, a base for, what about in advance setting up a program that does really good data, you know, collecting from them, sets up a very specific protocol so that as failures occur, you know how it was being run. You can do a little bit of preparation to turn what they're doing into much more valuable test data.
Yeah, and, very true.
So, yeah.
Well, I had one client, and this was years ago, is it was a military contract, and they were, I don't know, tier two or three in the program or something like that. And they're making a little sensor box to leave out the proprietary stuff. And they would get a contract to create 10 of these boxes. And they were expensive, high zoots boxes, but they would get a contract to make 10. And the way the contracts were written and the way their business model was, is they bought 10 components, you know, the bill of materials. Once they got it to a design that they were ready to build, they would C-121, they would buy 10 of those, right? It would be cheaper to buy a reel of 10,000 than to buy 10.
And, wow.
And they did that for every component. And so they were, up against the wall for reliability. Their customers are complaining and all this other stuff. And I said, well, let's use one of the units and actually test it, find out what fails. So you guys aren't guessing of what to improve. What? We won't be able to ship that? That's not possible. We only buy and build the exact number of units that we sell.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Really? Yeah. This is the way you do this?
Yeah. And it's not just with testing. You know, I've been so surprised with other ones where they, you know, in defining the things like what are the use case conditions, you know, which go far beyond testing. It has to do with application and kinds of things. And they don't have the data. They haven't really thought about kicking off the way to get the data to define that, you know, which requires, you know, a good amount of investment of time and engineering knowledge if you can't get any physical exercising of things to monitor. And even things like that to then begin to address that, you know, at a point out late in the game, it just brings everything to a screeching halt.
Power supplies are classic. These guys in Denver one time, they only had setups for 120-volt outlets. So that's the only thing they tested. And that was the only testing they did was they had to run, you know, firmware or other types of stuff. So they had to plug it in. And it says, well, it worked when we plugged it in. Right. The first unit plugged into Europe in the 220, 240 systems exploded.
Right. Exactly.
It's not that hard to get a power supply that provides 220 volts and 10 amps and plug it in.
Right. So here's the thing. So what do we do? I mean, as consultants and as, you know, as the reliability engineer on the team, how do we drive to make that happen? Is it having a standard checklist that we know, you know, for each activity and say, okay, we're doing a, you know, reliability growth program. Here's the checklist of prep in a general time frame, you know, for advanced, you know, an advancement of execution? Or,
well, I think there's two steps. There's the, you know, like halt testing, you know, like a reliability growth or halt testing or ALT. Here's the stuff we need to do And I think those specific tools, like FMEA, we need to do this, this, and this to kick off this study. And here's the general what it's going to take to make it happen. I think those we can create checklists, and there's books and books and books and papers that outline all the various options once you select it. But I think the first step is there's a reliability plan that lists, do halt. Well, that's not enough. It's what does halt tie to? What does it connect to? How are we going to use that? Why is it important? It's the first step is really which tools are we going to use and why? And here's why they're important. Here's their value, their future value. Without that, it's very easy to push it off. And because the guys allocating prototypes are getting requests from marketing, from sales, from the field service folks, from the firmware team, the software team, the engineers all want to get protos to put on their benches and work with. And reliability can be one of a major demand on the prototype allocation. But unless it's visible and why it's important to have those samples, which decisions you're going to be making based on that information, it's easy to push it off, to ignore it, to not think about it. And those other urgent and priorities get the samples.
So do you put in your early, you know, reliability program plan, actual dates for the steps leading up to it?
Oh, certainly. Because I wouldn't put stuff in a plan unless there was a decision based on the output of that task or element of the plan. You wouldn't just say in a plan, once we start building protos, do reliability testing. Well, one, do you need to do reliability testing? There's circumstances where you certainly don't. You know, oftentimes we would like to do some physical testing, but earlier in the stage, it's, well, what's our use environment? And how is that connecting to our test planning and risk assessment? You know, if we're like these power supply guys, if they know they're going to ship worldwide, well, somebody should actually write down what are all the various sources of current and voltage that we're going to be tapping into. And is that in the specification for the power supply? Which is very, very early in a program. it certainly affects reliability and quality of your system. And then later, is there a check step? And is it enough of a risk that we need to actually check it? And if so, well, it might take us 2 months to get the capital assets of a sophisticated power supply that we could run our system.
Yep.
And so the decision is, yes, our power supply will work worldwide. Here's the evidence. And if we need that level of information and details to say with confidence that, yes, this is going to work with this amount of evidence behind it, well, that might actually take a year to accomplish.
Yeah, right, right.
So I start with what's the decisions and what do we need to know in order to say, yes, ship this product or we need to change something. And there's many decision points through the process. So those become the milestones based on decision making. And then is what information do you need to in order to make a good decision to increase your chances of getting it right? And then that then starts to back up to what do we need to put in place now to make those things happen.
So it sounds like a little bit what you're saying is that it's our fault because does the reliability program plan have that detailed information in there and timeline? So let me ask you, I'll put you on the spot. That customer who didn't, you know, when you said you wanted to do testing and then when you came, you know, to the point where you wanted to initiate it and they said they didn't have units, had you indicated to them in the plan how many units you would need and any of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we
you did.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I joke with them at start. They says, well, how many samples are you going to need? Well, thousands. Yeah, I'm a statistician. It's thousands.
Right.
And I said, no, but really, how accurately do you need to know? I mean, what information do you need to know to make a decision? And so we started talking about the balance of what exactly are we going to test and what are the risks? And as we define those failure mechanisms that we have uncertainty about, and let's say it's a solder joint. Well, solder joint testing can take, you know, 6 weeks to 6 months. And how well do you need to know the answer? And says, oh, we just need to know that it doesn't have a 10% defect rate at 2 years, right? Well, that's a lot easier to do. And we have time, you know, if we can create test boards for a particular solder joint, or do we need to test in the full system? So what are the series of decisions we need to make in order to know how many samples we need? So we started lining those things out and they were tracking all of those things. But at some point it was, well, we had 10 samples, you know, that had all of these different components on it that we were going to evaluate. We got an urgent request from a sales group that wants to install this somewhere else. So we sold that unit. So your samples are now delayed 6 months.
Yeah,
you're at the back of the line now. Yep. And so what I missed in that reliability plan in the group I was working with was the larger context of why we're asking for those samples and how important they were and what's the consequence of not having them versus selling one unit.
Mm. Yeah. And how about other preparation things like, you know, goals and determining hard cutoff times for goals to be set? Because that's another one I find is that we talk early on about something and we decide on a goal. And then it seems to kind of, there seems to be this kind of idea that it's always there's opportunity to adjust it. When in fact, the consequence of adjusting it isn't not being accounted for, because that obviously affects dramatically quantity, time you're going to test, modeling things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's another one that always surprises me. And it's usually people pretty high up in the organization that do that. They kind of have this feeling that you can just move the goal around whenever you want and it doesn't affect the program. So it feels like I feel like I could benefit by kind of making a lockdown date saying, sure, we can discuss it and continue to alter it. But the impact of it on the program increases as time, you know, as time goes along and you continue to adjust it. So it's not even just samples.
Well, some organizations, I've seen this more in medical devices, is the quality organization will do a specification freeze. These are the specs and we're going to I always get verify and validate confused, but we're going to do V&V basically on these things before we sign off on release. And the an organization after organization is they don't include the reliability part in the lockdown. They euphemistically call it an objective, not a specification.
Right.
And so it can float. And most organizations tell me they do that because it's so hard to measure. Mm-hmm. And so the discussion generally goes into, well, is it important? Well, and they're rightfully in saying that the difference between 98% reliable at 2 years versus 97% reliable at 2 years is, yeah, it's important to our business model, but it's not the end of the day. If it's below 90% reliable at 2 years, we need to fix it.
Yep.
Right. But our goal is 98%. So I said, why don't just set two goals, make the lower one a specification and then mm-hmm. allocate it and use your existing system to track those and get the feedback for them so that you can actually say with some confidence that you're at least 90% and you've met that specification all the while working towards the 98% reliability.
Right.
And they're like, oh yeah, we can do that.
Right. Another way I do that I find helps people who are farther removed from the technology understand it is by saying we have a set reliability goal, but here's different parts in the program with a demonstrated confidence in that goal. Mm-hmm. So in other words, like, let's be okay with releasing the product at 70%, you know, statistical, you know, confidence in mm-hmm. the goal. And then a year after, we should be up to 80%. You know, with, you know, continuing internal testing and collecting field data.
Right.
And it kind of gives this very like understandable progression.
That's right. And it also provides that lower bound of we're at least doing enough to catch the big issues. You know, yeah. If reliability is not their dominant priority, then that's a good strategy where it's, we need to make sure that we do at least a threshold sensing mm-hmm. of we're good enough. And, yeah. But the design issue, the decision making, and we talked about this in some other episodes, is that still is aiming for perfection in many regards and mm-hmm. the right balance to use what we talked about in the last episode. And so, the decision makers have to have a way to know when they've crossed the boundary of this is not worth shipping. Mm-hmm. Kind right. of a thing. So right. It's exactly. It's part of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think my favorite one was by far, and I think I've told this story before, this guy was working on a portable inkjet printer. It was intended to be for the sales guy that's in his car all the time and he could print stuff. And I actually ran into a contractor that kind of jerry-rigged the system in his car, and he had just a regular home inkjet printer in his truck, and he was able to print out invoices and receipts and stuff right in his truck.
That's interesting.
You know, he had a little transformer in the back that gave him 120 power to his yep. printer, and it was really cool. And but this engineer said, this is the only prototype we had, you know, and it's a real small, compact little printer. And he says, what we want to find out is how long will it last? Mm-hmm. And between the two of us, I always blame him. He blames me. We dropped it.
Nice.
Right. And it shattered. It just shattered. And yeah. I said, it'll last about 2.5 feet.
Right. Yeah. And the question is, did anybody think that was funny at the time?
No. I mean, it was, you know, very expensive prototype they had, and the only one they had that was working. And no, it wasn't funny at the time, but it was, you know, if that's the only sample you have and that's the only one you're going to let me do anything with, and I'm not allowed to break it, you know, simply holding it and looking at it, I can probably spot, you know, here's areas of concern, here's some risks, here's things we need to evaluate, things like that. But there's not a lot I can do in testing from a reliability point of view that says this one unit is going to represent your population in any shape or fashion.
Yep.
So that's a challenge that we all face. And also, I think it might be worth another episode for us is reliability testing the only way to get you to your estimate, to know if you're good or not?
It's actually interesting you asked that. I'm dealing with that right now with a customer where they want to even before they've won the contract for what they are, you know, doing a bidding on, they want a reliability program plan and a prediction for what their reliability will likely be, which is pretty tricky. So we're trying to get as much information we can about legacy technology and then supplement what the new stuff is with anything we can find out there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an entirely, you know, non-physical, data sourced, associated to this design, exercise. So definitely a challenge and interesting, but, I'm sure we'll yield something that's useful for this stage of the program.
Yeah. And I think there's a whole sliding scale of what you can do, especially when you have a large, complex equipment and you're only going to make a handful of them anyway. You're not going to get thousands of units. But even mass-produced consumer products, you're probably constrained in how many units you can actually evaluate because it takes time and energy to test stuff and measure things.
Yep.
So it there's different constraints. We rarely ever get enough samples. I think circling back to our concept or the idea of this is the reliability plan and the evolution of, what you need to do to get to the information you need to make decisions, and reliability testing is often one of those things. If you're not nailing down, and oftentimes it takes more logistics work to make this all happen rather than reliability calculations and planning, it's the logistics side of actually keeping your samples allocated to you and protecting them. That planning extends well beyond just saying, program manager, we need 10 samples.
Right.
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 It takes a bit more work than that. You got to help them understand and arm them with the information so that they can defend it if they're the champion for this.
Yeah, exactly. What's the consequences? Very, very important to have that ready to go.
That's right. Well, let's ask our listeners. I'm sure there's a few of you that have had less samples than you really needed. What did you do? How did you? There's one part of our job that is responding to changing circumstances. If you were hoping to get 30 samples and they said no, you only get 3. How do you communicate that change in the risk? And what can you actually do to help support making decisions? On the other hand, is what are the techniques you've used to prevent that from happening? What could you share with our audience and with us, and we'll be glad to share it forward, is what works to make sure that the reliability program and the doesn't get sideswiped further down, for example, with the polling of samples you're counting on. This is a touchy area, and it's one that shows how well your reliability program is viewed within the organization. But it does take a lot of work, and oftentimes outside of being just strictly a reliability engineer. So it's I think there's many ways to solve this, Adam. We're going to have to come back to this, see what kind of comments we get. We'll come back to that and share some of the best practices.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks, Adam. And I know that we're in the middle of the holiday season when this episode's going to come out. So are you going to cut your food budget, actually?
No, not at all. Actually, we're taping this just after Thanksgiving. Right now, there's no food. That sounds enticing. I've had so much pie during so many inappropriate times during the day. pretty much, I'm done for a while.
You're stocked up. You're ready for the winter. You got your layer on.
Totally.
Oh, that's cool. All right. Well, thanks, Adam. And we'll talk again soon. And I'm going to go top off my cup of tea here as I'm moved beyond coffee for the day.
Cool.
And we'll go forward with that. All right. Great. Thanks, Adam.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.